One dose of corticosteroids alters the expression of about 30% of your genome. And the critical care people are worried about the blood pressure, but there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Welcome back to Peas Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
So, Alice, who are we speaking with today?
Today, we are speaking with the Dr. Zimmerman. And this is not just a deep dive in steroids and septic shock. This is a deep, deep dive. We're covering everything from the basic science to what Dr. Zimmerman himself does at the bedside. My other favorite part of this episode is the way that he really bakes in what he thinks that our field needs to prioritize for research.
That's right. And as a reminder, Dr. Zimmerman is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, the former chief and director of the pediatric ICU at Seattle Children's. He's a past president of SCCM, and he's a co-principal investigator of the SHIPS trial.
Zach, thank you for coordinating my number one celebrity encounter. Let's get right to the interview.
And this might be a good time to come back to our case. So think about that patient who has the indwelling central line coming in with your suspect bacteremia, has overt evidence of septic shock with poor perfusion. You've given, say, 40 mLs per kilo. Clinically, you look at them and you're considering them to be euvolemic versus maybe slightly hypervolemic. You're ratcheting up your epinephrine infusion, say you're 0.15 to 0.2 micrograms per kilo per minute. You're thinking, this patient might benefit from corticosteroids. What's your dose of hydrocortisone that you might give in a situation similar to this?
First of all, I'm not getting nervous yet. Not at all. My colleagues are. I'm not nervous at all yet. These patients in the adult trials are on 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 micrograms per kilo per minute of norepinephrine when they were enrolled in the trial, especially Dr. Anand's trial showing the best mortality benefit. These patients were very sick on high doses of norepinephrine. You know, I think, first of all, I would check the serum calcium. I would check the patient's history. If it's a little squirt, is there a newborn screening that said, no, he doesn't have congenital adrenal hyperplasia? Has the patient received any etomidate or been on ketoconazole or one of those Zolds that might alter the metabolism? Is this a kid with asthma who gets steroids like every 3 weeks? Is this a cancer patient who's seen steroids or a rheumatologic patient who's seen steroids? Does the patient have some abnormality of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis? You know, there's a bunch of patients that absolutely should get hydrocortisone stress dose, not waiting for anything, just right off the bat. If I'm going to give steroids, I tell people, grab a random cortisol level. You know, ideally, it would be nice if you did a corticotropin stimulation test, but, you know, that's going to take an hour, and we're not patient, and the patient may not be stable to do that either, but anybody can do a random cortisol. And if it comes back less than 10, go for it. I'm not going to stand in your way. But if it comes back 40 or 35, you know, I would stop. I wouldn't continue dosing steroids. If you're not going to change what you're doing anyway, then don't get the random cortisol. But I think it's a piece of useful information if you see what this patient is doing before you provide this exogenous hydrocortisone dosing. If I'm actually going to do this, I would load with 2 milligrams per kilogram of hydrocortisone and then administer 1 milligram per kilogram every 6 hours. And there's equivalent dosing based on body surface area. When to stop is controversial, but most people would say, you know, when the vasoactives are weaned off, then it's probably time to wean off the hydrocortisone as well.
That's really helpful to hear. And just to summarize, just to make sure I understand completely, would it be fair to say that you don't typically entertain the idea of stress-dose hydrocortisone absent risk factors that you've already discussed, like chronic steroid use or maybe etomidate exposure? You wouldn't typically entertain the use of corticosteroids unless the epi dose is getting up to 0.3, 0.4 micrograms per kilo per minute. And then you might also stop stress-dose corticosteroids if that random cortisol did in fact come back elevated.
True, true, and true.
That's so helpful. And Alice, I'm not sure what your experience is, but I feel like in my little bit of practice, we would generally reach for steroids before we get to 0.2 or 0.3 or 0.4 of epi.
Yeah. Also, being raised in this environment in which we don't have the parity maybe that our patients deserve, I definitely would be before 0.3 or 0.4. And I feel often we would be on like 0.2 of epi and 0.2 of norepi. And so, you know, you add it up and it's 0.4. But
yeah. You know, there's no good evidence for my opinion. And if Joe Carcillo was here, we would have a disagreement about this, but both would be right, I think, in their own experience. So that's why we're trying to do the trial. And so if you're going to do an intervention, you know, you have to bite your tongue and try to go with the study. But yes, personally, if I gave that dose of stress dose hydrocortisone because nothing was working right, and the random cortisol level came back at 40, yes, I would stop the hydrocortisone because there are adverse effects. I always like to tell people, there's a paper that I could send you the reference. One dose of corticosteroids alters the expression of about 30% of your genome. And the critical care people are worried about the blood pressure, but there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Sure, the physiology sure is complex. I have a couple quick follow-up questions about nuances around your practice. Say your patient might have another indication for steroids. You mentioned COVID-19 and ARDS. So would you might consider using methylprednisolone or dexamethasone if they also have concomitant shock?
Yeah, I would challenge your depiction as indication for ARDS. Show me the evidence for that. Even in adult medicine, they're still arguing whether methylprednisolone for ARDS is the right approach. But Umberto Maduri, what a beautiful name. He's the guy that has promoted asthma dosing of methylprednisolone to hasten the repair phase of ARDS. And in his trials, you know, there's been a good benefit, shorter duration of ventilation and outcomes, but it hasn't been routinely replicated in other studies. But Zach, to be fair, yes, I think there are some indications. I have to, again, say that, for example, our most recent clinical related is MISC from COVID in kids. And I have to say that I would agree that if you give the steroid, the blood pressure and the hemodynamics seem, at least on my view, to improve more quickly than if you don't. So I think there are instances where you probably should use something else like methylprednisolone, because that's just the steroid that was studied for that particular indication.
And one more quick one. What are we to do with fludrocortisone? It seems like only a minority of trials is actually studied alongside. What should we do about that?
What we need is a platform trial for pediatric sepsis, like the adults have for COVID right now. There's actually two or three of them that are ongoing. And in this platform, first of all, you'd have to find somebody who would be willing to fund it. But we would maybe start with the SHIPS trial. And after that, we might add, for example, fludrocortisone, yes or no. We might add on there other endocrine interventions or other new things that might come along. And just not study hydrocortisone for sepsis, but sepsis, or whatever disease you want to pick. And this would require a network of hospitals, ideally with a system to download the data from the EMR directly, so you don't need research coordinators to do this data transposition thing, and the computer keeping track of the patients who are actually seeing benefit from one intervention or the other, enrolling more patients in the arm that seems to be beneficial, and moving in that direction. I think ideally that's where we should be headed. I think there's a number of other things besides fludrocortisone that might be helpful. I think the other one that comes to mind for me is oxandrolone, not for hemodynamics, but would it prevent this muscle catabolism that occurs? It certainly works for burn patients, and the inflammatory response and the atrogene thing for burn patients is exactly the same. Well, I think it's pretty much the same for burn patients as it is for septic patients. So that would be another one.
That's a really good point for our listeners and really for me as well. Will you define what oxandrolone is?
Oxandrolone is a androgen, and it is one of many in that class, but it is valuable for protein accretion into muscle. That's why some athletes use it to become stronger. But the evidence from Shriner Burn Center in Galveston, they've been studying this for 30 or 40 years, it's pretty unequivocal that in that setting, and this inflammatory response in a burn patient can go on a year after they leave the hospital, it is beneficial in terms of reducing a loss of lean body mass and getting it back after the burn.
Oh, wow. That does sound like a powerful intervention for probably a lot of ICU patients.
Yes, I think there's an opportunity there. And if you ever want to collaborate, let me know. I think it's an important unanswered question, just like fludrocortisone.
Is the research infrastructure you're describing, do you feel like the pediatric oncologists are already doing that in a way, or is it still very clunky?
Oh, no. The Children's Oncology Group, I think this is the conglomeration of previous, at least two different networks, is hugely methodical in their approach. Yes, they will get a trial going, and they may have several tweaks in it as they go along. They do a lot of trials with small number of patients, too, when they're starting for safety and efficacy. But I think they have sort of been doing this platform model for a number of years, yes. I mean, the other alternatively, this was what Randall Wetzel would say of the virtual PICU, is we just need to collect enough data. And now we have the opportunity to get more and more of it into a database. And if we arrange this data in the right way and ask the right questions, we might be able to get to the same answers, to the same conclusions. So, you know, Palisi is a good example of a bunch of hospitals that get together to do clinical research and pediatric critical care. If a group of hospitals could come together and get their data collecting system, this is going to be the next revolution in clinical research. The research coordinators are going to do stuff like, I'm going to ask you questions about quality of life now. That's what they should be doing, not taking data from one thing, putting it onto a piece of paper, then putting it into a database. That needs to happen seamlessly and accurately, and there are now tools to do this. But we need to get over this psychosocial political question about how are we going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
If China decides to do this, they're going to say, we're going to use this system. I don't know if it probably won't be Cerner or Epic. It'll be something else. But if they get the same system in every hospital and it's installed in every hospital the same way, that will be hugely powerful for clinical research.
It sure seems like the answers to many of our clinical questions at the bedside can be answered by big data, by having access to all the thousands and tens of thousands of encounters that happen across the United States and across the world that might infer future answers to questions that we have at the bedside. So Dr. Zimmerman, it's been a great conversation thus far. I've learned so much. I just wanted to offer this as a summary and let me know if I'm getting anything not quite right. It seems if you have that patient that comes into your ICU with known primary or secondary adrenal insufficiency, you're certainly going to provide that kid steroids if they're in shock, and also if they're on long-term corticosteroid use. It seems that maybe it's not as firm if they're on a short course of steroids, like maybe they had an asthma exacerbation a couple of weeks ago. But what do you think about etomidate, one dose of etomidate? Is that something you would always give steroids if they're in shock?
Absolutely. There is excellent data from Belgium. There's a group of critical care people over there that do a lot of endocrine research, and they studied this proactively in patients undergoing surgery who were intubated with etomidate and then looked at their adrenal function, and basically you knock it out for 2 days. So I would say, from my point of view, I think that evidence is really very good. And yes, I would prescribe hydrocortisone in that situation.
Oh, that's good to know. When you think about the use of an ACTH stimulation test, even when we get those results back, how do we know what cortisol cutoff we should be using?
Well, I think if you're going to do a stimulation test, I think there is pretty universal agreement that a delta of at least 9 indicates sufficiency of the adrenal response. Some people might say a total greater than 18 is another way to do it, but I would say the best data for this is from Dr. Anand's group, adult critical care endocrine people in France. They published in American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, I believe in 2012, where they had a large group of critically ill adults and kept track of all of the cortisol metabolites. Their best definitions of adrenal insufficiency in a critically ill patient was a free cortisol less than 2, a total cortisol less than 10, or ACTH stimulation delta cortisol less than or equal to 9. So he's been studying this all his life, and I think that's the best data.
I agree with your previous statement that it seems logistically difficult to coordinate and slow to get results back doing an ACTH stim test in active or worsening shock. Can you think of clinical scenarios where you would, like someone's failing to progress or you feel that you have time?
Oh, yes. I was on service this past week, and we have a little guy in there who has some chronic comorbidities as in the ICU. But blood pressure is chronically low. In the past, he has had random cortisol, and, you know, they range from 10 to 20, 40. They're different for each of the checks. So I scratched my head, and I can't do that. So I said, you know, let's look and see what his aldosterone was, and it was undetectable. I thought, oh, I'm going to be a hero on rounds tomorrow. So we started on fludrocortisone. And it has not made a bit of difference in his blood pressure. And then one of the residents suggested, you know, why don't we actually do a stimulation test and just do this right? So we did a ACTH stimulation test, and I don't know the results back. But this is a patient who's chronically hypotensive. He actually got started on an epinephrine drip that gets titrated. It's not that high, but can't figure out what's going on. So, yes. There's another child who is intermittently, completely different story, but probably a prolonged viral sepsis, but the same question. And so we did a corticotropin stimulation test on him at the beginning of last week and couldn't blame it on lack of hydrocortisone. He responded very, very well. So yeah, I think there are instances. And I would just urge people to be intellectually honest before you just start somebody on a new medication. If you have a way to test whether it's going to really be beneficial or not, it's pretty easy to do, and I think we should.
Another practical question about deciding who to provide corticosteroids to. We've mentioned previously, if you get a random cortisol and it's 30 or 40, maybe that patient doesn't need stress dose hydrocortisone. But where exactly do you draw the line between giving hydrocortisone or not? I've seen in the literature maybe 18 comes to mind, but what's your practice?
I get nervous if the random cortisol is less than 10. It's from Dr. Anon. If it's less than 5, I'm thinking this kid's got some congenital problem that somebody missed, when it's really low or zero like that. The upper limit, if it's right at 10, I'm nervous, you know, might be missing something. I don't have a specific number. I think it depends on the situation, but 30 or 40, I'd be very comfortable just sitting tight. And probably 10 is my real cutoff, but I might be nervous if somebody's 10 or 15 or 12 and they're not doing well. I have to admit, yes.
You mentioned hyperglycemia potentially is a really important component to this whole thing. How do you monitor for the side effects of corticosteroids? What are you watching?
You know, I think we're monitoring side effects of corticosteroids as part of our routine practice all the time. So we're checking serum glucoses, and if they're abnormal, we start checking them more frequently and figure out something to do with them. We just started a child on high-dose dexamethasone for HLH 2 days ago, and his glucose went through the roof, and now he's on an insulin drip. So if a patient has anything that looks red coming out of his NG tube, we test it and see if it's bloody. That's routine practice. Most hospitals now are checking the CAPD score or something similar for delirium. So those three are all kind of routine practice. Increased catabolism, we're not generally doing that. There's ways to do that now with ultrasonography, even measuring the width of the diaphragmatic muscle. That's possible, not in my hands, but also the rectus femoris muscle, you can monitor very easy with ultrasonography. So we could if we wanted to, and there are people researching that. And let's see, what is left? Immunodeficiency. We don't have a good way of doing that. Mm-hmm. but maybe we will when host gene expression comes into vogue and we have it for routine monitoring. We may have a test that says this is immunodeficiency. Although I would say, now that I think about it, the reason that you get immunodeficient from corticosteroids is that it induces lymphocyte apoptosis. So certainly lymphopenia in steroids is a bad combination, and you should, if you can, avoid the two together.
Yeah, it's really helpful to hear. I've really enjoyed our conversation thus far. We talked on the big picture studies that are directing our knowledge of this intervention. We talked about the logistics of what we do at the bedside and how we can possibly try to pick and choose which patients are most likely to benefit from steroids. As we finish our conversation, the time we have left, I'd like to look forward at what research is coming. And certainly we want to hear much more about this SHIP study. So as you see it now, what are the important studies that need to be done? And please tell us more about SHIPs.
Well, the SHIPs study is stress hydrocortisone in pediatric septic shock. It is a venture between Canada and the United States. I think I mentioned that. At the present time, we're also increasing recruitment to include Brazil, Asian PICUs, kind of with a central organizing place in Singapore. Israelis are interested. Because enrollment has been kind of stagnant in the United States, COVID certainly didn't help. We're looking out to get more sites to enroll. It's more complex, but the results will be more generalizable. This trial has three specific aims. The first is, does stress dose hydrocortisone have an effect on reducing this composite endpoint of either death or severe deterioration of quality of life assessed at 1 month in relation to baseline quality of life? That's a neat thing that hasn't been done before, but that idea, mixing mortality and morbidity as an outcome measure, is being picked up in a number of other places. The second specific aim is hydrocortisone associated with significant adverse events that we should be paying attention to? And the third is validation of the pediatric persevere and endotyping tools to predict who would best benefit from corticosteroids with the least risk. We're actively recruiting. It's a big network of hospitals. We have a long ways to go, and we need to increase our enrollment or we're going to be at risk for getting our funding pulled. And that would really be unfortunate because it took so long to get organized. And then finally getting good funding from the national NICHD at NIH, as well as the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act in the FDA. So we're trying to move forward, trying to get more sites. I think there might be more equipoise in Brazil and in Asia than there is in the United States. So we'll see. I think the logistics will be trickier in getting that follow-up quality of life assessment, but we're trying. We really would like to get an answer to this question. I think it would be useful for our field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And by validating the pediatric persevere endotyping tools, you're endotyping these patients, right?
We are, yes. We are endotyping the patients, that is their gene expression, as well as quantifying these five proteins that Hector identified as predictive of mortality or complex ICU course.
What's the age group? Is it all PICU patients?
These are patients that are at least estimated gestational age 37 weeks, so we're not in any NICUs, out through 17 and a half years of age. Why do we pick that weird number? So that patients don't become adults during the trial and we have to reconsent them afterwards. We do ask for assent. That is, we ask your parents if it was okay that you could be in this. Is it still okay with you? We do that, but instead of getting a signed consent, we're just going with an assent model.
That's so interesting. I've never thought about that before.
Yep. Just practicalities of doing clinical research. In Canada, they actually have a deferred consent model. They just enroll the patients, and when things stabilize, they tell the parents what's going on. And actually, that's worked pretty well for them. They maintain most of the patients in the study.
Well, Dr. Zimmerman, this has been a great conversation. Over the past 70 or 80 minutes, I've definitely learned so much about this topic, but I feel like we've only scratched the surface. I really appreciate the mentorship that we start off the conversation with. I'm very excited to share that with our listeners. And we certainly appreciate your time today and appreciate all that you've done for critical care and especially this trial that's under works.
Thanks again for the invitation. It's been nice talking to both of you, Alex and Zach. And, you know, if anyone has any questions or comments, suggestions, ideas, collaborative notions, you know, jerry.zimmerman@seattlechildrens.org. I'm always interested in talking to anybody about good science.
Oh, well, thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedescritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedescrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.
Zach, do you have any conflicts of interest to disclose?
I don't think I have any conflicts other than Furman and Zimmerman is the best textbook ever, and every fellow should have one.
Fantastic. Thank you.